The best quote-unquote truth or path to truth isn't through the perfectly cropped camera zoom. It's through people who were recording something else in the background or someone else that saw something that was out of the ordinary. And it's a composite that helps to either make or unsettle the idea of this one single truth. You know, like no one, if something happened right now, you and I would remember it differently. We're inherently wired for the truth to be subjective. So I find that by putting everything in one single container, it sort of facilitates an understanding of that and forces the reader to make their own mind up. And that's what's important.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, and here we are at Saturday at the Society for News Design's conference in Washington, D.C. I got in early and got to sit in on a presentation by Dan Archer, a graphic journalist who uses comics to tell immersive stories, quite often of things that are very deep and dramatic, things you wouldn't necessarily expect. The audio that I recorded for his presentation, of course, didn't turn out, but I actually was lucky enough to sit down with Dan after his presentation and have a brief chat about what he talked about and some of the, you know, his philosophy about immersive journalism and what he does with his comics. I think it turned out to be a really nice little conversation, and I hope you'll enjoy it. If this is the first time listening to It's All Journalism, we're a weekly podcast that focuses on media issues. You can find out more about us at itsalljournalism.com, and you can follow us at All Journalism on Twitter. Here's Dan. So what came first? The drawing or your interest in journalism?
I was always drawing. I guess as a kid, it was probably the easier extension. I read a bit of comics, but then like in my sort of later teenage years, I dropped off. I mean, I read every once in a while, but it wasn't until I discovered Joe Sacco when I was doing my undergrad in languages, actually, at Cambridge, that it sort of completely blew my mind. And I saw Palestine in Spanish, and I just knew that it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was like beautiful to hold, but also really engrossing. And then I finished uni and I tried to work like publishing graphic novels. I started a comic at Cambridge, and I worked for Penguin trying to promote graphic novels, but fundamentally I wanted to do my own thing. So I looked at journalism programs, but there was nothing that had visual journalism or anything like that. You know, I would talk about the Illustrated News and stuff like that from, you know, way back when in Britain, and people just weren't doing it. So I thought it was more important to get the skills themselves of you know, how to put pages together and that sort of thing in a more formal context, and then move directly into just freelancing straight from that.
It's funny you say Joe Sacco. We've had a few comics artists on, comics journalists on the podcast, and Joe Sacco seems to be somebody who blows a lot of people's mind and sort of opens up the door for that type of journalism. That, and of course, a Mouse from Spiegelman, those are the ones people point to. So the big thing that you've been working on over the last year, the thing that a lot of people are talking about is the Ferguson. Could you sort of, you know, walk me through how that process started? Did you, you know, how did you get that assignment? What was your thinking and how you wanted to cover it?
Yeah, I started it as part of my fellowship at the Reynolds Journalism Institute in Columbia, Missouri. It was, you know, obviously it's a completely heart-wrenchingly tragic incident, and one that is by no means alone in the context of police shootings of African-American men. But it happened 10 days after I arrived in Missouri, so as any journalist, being 2 hours away, I had to go down, and I went down and did some sketches, and Medium were immediately interested in picking them up. So they did that. At the time, actually, I was already working on the human trafficking reporting that I'd done in Nepal the previous year, and I was using that as my virtual reality, and I had shot some 360 video, and I wanted to incorporate that into things. But then newsrooms were having a hard time extrapolating that into a more relevant, timely topic. So the Ferguson shooting scene seemed ideal to sort of port that into it. So I went down, and immediately there was sort of interest in, because no one had really juxtaposed all the different accounts together in a non-textual format.
One of the things that I really liked in the demonstration you gave today, you ended it with the Oculus sort of immersive aspect of it. Was that something that you had envisioned at the beginning, or was that something that sort of developed as you were, you know, plotting this out?
It was funny because I sort of tiptoed around it at first because I wasn't entirely convinced of its accessibility. You still need quite a rip-roaring new fast PC. The headset itself is $350. That's not that much, but obviously by the general public standard, that's a lot, unless you're a gamer. And so those were barriers. But then I think we're sort of ahead on the S-curve, as Amy Webb would say. So we just need to... that is where... For me, that's the most interesting part of it. Not necessarily the post-production part, the distribution model for the hardware, like the Oculus and all the sort of plethora of other devices out there, but like the 3D, the game engines. So I've taught myself Maya this year and Unity, a little bit of Unity, enough to be able to sort of familiarize myself with the workflow and people who can actually know what they're doing. And that for me has been the interesting part in how my storytelling has had to change from 2D to 3D.
How many times did you, for lack of better description, tell that story in the different formats? I mean, did you originally do sort of a comics, or did this one thing sort of flow into the other and it became the end product, which is a sort of 3D? And who even knows if that's the end product?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. That's the beauty of it, really. The beauty in the sort of obstacle is that there isn't really ever an end, as we know, to any story. But with comics, I think comics in themselves are quite funny or like well-suited to this context because they are so much work that they make everything else seem more or less achievable. You know, like I said to myself, oh, well, I'd already instinctively thought, oh, I want to draw it out. And so I thought, oh, that's no problem. I'll just draw it out. You know, it turns out, like, I remember the Dorian Wilson comic was 30 panels. The Dorian Johnson comic was 30 panels. The Darren Wilson comic is 59 off the top of my head. So it was like pages and pages of content. But I had originally designed it. I always imagined a 3D environment, but I had my original design actually worked with notifications. So it would ping your iPhone or your smartphone with the comics panels, and then deeper dive documents like the police autopsy report and stuff would be tablet-based. So I had created a CMS with a series of push notifications so that if you had multiple devices, like iTunes, it would sort of recognize which devices you had and then say, okay, would you like to be alerted across these different devices for the different content that you see? That was my in a sort of more transmedia way so that people could experience it in 3D but then take some of the content away. But I soon found that it was overwhelming to people. So I had to dial it down a bit.
Dial it down a little bit. Yeah. A couple of things I wanted to particularly talk about. One was the one about the Canadian woman who was attacked, and the way that you sort of told that story, you know, in sort of a comics way, but then also, you know, I guess was it Vice or was it Medium or who was it who picked that up?
CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Okay, and then but they wanted to it would not just be a straight comic, but was that their decision or was it your idea to sort of make it more immersive and make it sort of animated?
Well, they're first and foremost a TV channel, so they needed something that would run on their evening broadcast slot. So we had to figure out a way of doing something that could take up 2.5 minutes total of airtime. And so I sort of designed a new kind of workflow that's sort of pseudo-animation but not really keyframed to sort of find the balance in between the two.
Yeah, and you ended up doing that in Flash?
No, actually, I did that in After Effects.
Okay.
And Flash I did for the Nassau Square project, but as we all know, you know, Apple killed Flash, so.
Well, and that was the other one I wanted to ask you about, and that was I found very interesting because it was almost built off of a map where this is an intersection where something happened, and then you were able to click on different elements of it and get not just comic panels, but also, you know, deep dive into documents and things, is sort of, again, providing a different perspective to an event. Could you sort of talk about how you put that together?
Yeah, I mean, that was very intensive. I did that as part of my Stanford fellowship in 2010 to 11. That for every event, basically, I mean, those of you that are familiar with Flash, I did a button, a rollover, and then the three different states of on, off, and hovering. And I just can't describe how much that was. A lot of work. I mean, the purpose there again was to represent, I suppose, more of like a 2D space, the idea of multiple players doing different sort of the same, evoking the same sort of Rashomon kind of feel of a story, but trying to link a ton of different documents and evidence together, but inside a story arc. I think that sometimes that's often lost in an infographic where you have a ton of data, but it's not really, the story itself isn't that compelling.
Now, before we started talking, we talked a little bit about the fact that, you know, we both know Aaron Polgreen, who does Symbolia. And, you know, I've talked to a number of different people who are sort of doing comics journalism on the podcast, and it always seems to boil down, I don't want to say the whole, all they talk about, but they have to address the fact that there's this perception that, you know, somehow what you're doing is yellow journalism, or it's something that's, I don't want to say not true journalism, but, you know, it's a hard sell sometimes. Do you feel that way?
I think it used to be. I think now that not only are editors more open-minded, but we see that the people are more visually literate, media literate, and it's not just a question. That, I think, is more of a prejudiced point of view that is increasingly outmoded. Like, people, I think, recognize that comics is very honest. We're not, I don't make any claims to owning the truth, and nor can anyone. I think text has a misconceived and maybe slightly unworthy authority that people mistakenly attribute to it. Images, on the other hand, people immediately are suspicious of, and that is a good thing in journalism. I want people to question. I only had one entry point into this story, you know. But you should. I still hold myself to the same ethics of these are the direct quotes. You know, this isn't. And typically, actually, I'll always accompany my pieces, or at least the VR pieces, with like a methodology, and show people exactly what I've done and be as transparent as possible.
Why do you think it's important to do that transparency?
I think because people with unfamiliar stuff, people need a certain degree of reassurance that what they're seeing is legitimate, and they're also very interested in the process, and it's not just something. I'm really trying to dismantle the idea that it's something that I just sat in a room on my own and dreamt up. Like, the same amount of legwork and reporting was involved for a regular story as for this, if not more. I mean, the thing people forget, to represent something physically in visual space requires a significant amount of effort, perhaps even more than in text. I could say right now, you and I are sitting in a room, and there are, you know, around under 10 people here. They're all women, right? That conjures up a certain degree, a certain image in people's heads. But if I had to draw it, I would need considerable more information. I'd need to know, what are they wearing? What is the age demographic? What are they doing? You know, and so people forget that.
What I find interesting about this sort of storytelling, and especially it was very demonstrated when you were showing the Oculus in your presentation, where you sort of ended it by going down a hallway and there was audio from somebody who was at the scene, you know, in an apartment on Skype, talking to his girlfriend.
Glide video chat. Yeah. Yeah.
Video chat. And what that adds to the story is more of that sense of place, that this is somebody who's not necessarily witnessing it, but because of what he was doing at the moment, he was able to pick. They were able to pick up the gunshots,
right.
And again, it's just another aspect of immersing your reader in that experience, mm-hmm. and putting them in. It says this is a real life place. This is a real life situation, and this is how it's kind of unfolding from all these different perspectives that you, as an artist, you as a reporter, are sort of blending into this story that you're telling.
But that's what I find. I think the best quote unquote. Truth or path to truth isn't through the perfectly cropped camera zoom. It's through people who were recording something else in the background, or someone else that saw something that was out of the ordinary. And it's a composite that helps to make either make or unsettle the idea of this one single truth. You know, like, no one, if something happened right now, you and I would remember it differently. We're inherently wired for the truth to be subjective. So I find that by putting everything in one single container, it sort of facilitates an understanding of that and forces the reader to make their own mind up. And that's what's important.
Yeah, and you're the one who mentioned it. You mentioned Rashomon, and that should probably be the first week of all journalism schools. They should make people watch that, not only because it's a great film, but because it talks, you know, it's very revelatory about people's prejudices and their perspective and how things can be so different. You shared the same event, but had a completely different experience.
Well, right. It's funny. On the wall down the hall, there's a quote from John Knight that says, "Find the truth and print it." Well, it's like, okay, number one, what is the truth? Number two, who are you? Number three, where are you printing it? Like, all of those prejudices affect a reader and their approach to it. And so you're looking at people's, like you said, their almost like their agenda. And that's a question that, as a reporter, you get asked all the time. Who are you from? You know, why are you talking to me? What do you want to know? Where are you, what's your agenda? And so I think it's really important for people, what I want to use this experience for, in addition to building empathy and as a way into story, is to get people to recognize their own inherent prejudices. Like, are you more inclined to side with Darren Wilson or Michael Brown? Just before you knew anything, what is your gut telling you? Why is that? Who are you? You know, I'm not asking for some sort of existential reassessment of identity, but I think it's often forgotten that that's the screen that we project everything onto. And so if we can be more accountable for actually trying to recognize that before we dive into someone else's already inherently subjective view, then we can get that one step closer to the truth that is printed on the wall down the hill.
And I think it's probably something that's important that all forms of journalism, all types of journalists should be thinking about, and the fact that you're sort of, you know, swimming in some new water here and coming, you know, blazing trails, as it were, that in a sense you almost have to sort of justify, this is what I'm doing, this is why I'm doing it this way, and to try to, you know, get people to question all the types of content that they're getting, whether it's in text, video, or photos, or whatever.
Right. I mean, it's kind of funny in a way, because comics was the great, I said this in my talk, but comics was the great entry point for getting me to think in this sort of visual storytelling mode. But similarly, I've been defending comics. Am I using, oh, comics is news, huh? And now it's, oh, VR is news, huh? So I'm sure in a few years it'll probably be like, oh, 3D holograms is news, that's interesting. Or, oh, we've dispensed with screens, why is that? You know, there's always, people are always reluctant to, not embrace, but like to acknowledge new forms as they come. I'm not saying, and I certainly don't want to be guilty of falling for the next shiny thing. But I do think the potential is just unmatched for this sort of new breakout storytelling.
I had sort of the same prejudice when I was at ONA last year, and I put on the Oculus Rift, and or is it Oculus? It's just
for the Gannett.
Was looking, flowing through it. But once you get into it, once you understand that it's just a completely different type of perspective and a different way of telling a story, then it's kind of like, okay, yeah, maybe this is a little high end. Maybe it's we're a few years away from people able to have access to all this technology. But it's, you know, we need to expand the way we tell our stories.
Right. I mean, it's funny because, again, it's just mindset. We've been doing audio guides through rich visual interfaces in museums for decades. So it makes sense that it's sort of ported into a more personal sphere. I'm not saying we've got it right either. You know, like, there are plenty of things we have to learn. But I think what is interesting is there are a lot of naysayers, but the conversion rate once you experience it is very, very high. Few people take it off and be like, I'm indifferent. Most people are like, wow. And so it's a question of how can we make this more accessible? And that for me, I think, is the biggest challenge, and one that I'm trying to really tackle is, like, I don't want this to be I don't want middle-class white people, basically, to have the monopoly on it.
Yes. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you, it's sort of the subtext that's been coming through recent podcasts that we've been doing about empathy, about empathetic journalism. Your company is
Empathetic Media.
How important is this to what you're doing?
It's fundamental. I think that whole idea of relating to subjects, that was why I started doing comics in the first place. It was to try and tell the reader, particularly in the sphere of human trafficking, it was because I was so tired of these third person sort of like, so-and-so is a downtrodden survivor, she's been through it all. It's like, and then these photos of, you know, with their faces blurred, objectifying them even more. You know, it's like, I want to hear their voices. I want to see what they see. It's usually mundane and quotidian, and it's not as dramatic as people say, but that's the whole point. It's a very real, I want to try and foster the connection to people, because that's what we look for in a story. That's why the best stories are told face to face.
Well, this has been great. How can people find out more about your stuff?
You can follow me, Arch Comics, ARCHCOMIX, on Twitter, or Empathetic Media, or empatheticmedia.com.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.